Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode on Thursday, May 1st, 2025, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Disability funding crisis averted as HUB signs bipartisan $122 million rescue package. Are local officials duty-bound to certify elections? Arizona ruling creates new doubt. I wanted to kill them all. Inmate admits to targeting child sex offenders in prison killings. And let's get started. Our first story is an update from last week's news. Disability funding crisis averted as HUB signs bipartisan $122 million rescue package. Parents who fought for months celebrate victory, but remain, quote, unsettled by political battles. By Caitlin Sievers, April 24, 2025. Arizona's developmentally disabled community breathed a collective sigh of relief Thursday as a bipartisan solution to an impending budget cliff was finally signed into law. The agreement to supply the Division of Developmental Disabilities with $122 million in supplemental funding to get it through the end of the fiscal year passed through the State House of Representatives Wednesday evening and was approved by the Senate on Thursday. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs signed the bill into law Thursday afternoon. Kathleen Muldoon's 11-year-old son, who has cerebral palsy and is blind and deaf, relies on DDD services. She said she ran around her house in celebration after the vote on Wednesday. Muldoon is a mother of three and a full-time medical school professor, but still trudged to the Capitol twice a week for the past few months to fight for the developmentally disabled community. "I feel relieved, and I also feel unsettled," she told the Arizona Mirror. The approval of House Bill 2945 came after months of political fighting and accusations between the Republicans, who control both chambers of the legislature, and Hobbs, who they accuse of causing the funding gap through fiscal mismanagement. The bill headed to her desk after bipartisan votes of 48-11 in the House and 28-1 in the Senate, with only Republicans, most of the members of the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, voting against it. Legislators who are constitutionally responsible for funding the state government have had since January to negotiate a supplemental funding bill, but they fought for months to come to a solution that would get through both chambers without getting a veto from Hobbs. Muldoon and Michelle Thorne, co-founder of the advocacy organization Care for the Caregivers, both said they were thankful for support from the community and for the legislators who worked behind the scenes to make sure they didn't face devastating service cuts. But they're also walking away from the last couple of months of intense advocacy at the Capitol with resentment for the political showmanship that some Republicans displayed throughout the process. "I hope that in the future, if they want to have negotiations with us, that they actually do it in good faith and they don't play politics with this community ever again," Thorne said. The funding bill takes effect immediately because it had emergency language and passed with a two-thirds majority in both chambers, allowing it to bypass the normal 90-day delay from signature to implementation. Getting that supermajority on board was crucial, since DDD was expected to run out of money May 1st, meaning that the nearly 60,000 Arizonans with conditions like cerebral palsy, autism, and other developmental disabilities would lose access to services they depend on. the Parents as Paid Caregivers program, which was responsible for the majority of DDD's budget deficit, trains parents and then pays them to provide in-home care to their own children instead of third-party caregivers, but only if they require extraordinary care above and beyond typical parenting tasks. The PPCG program expanded over the last year from about 3,000 participants to around 6,000, even after Republicans in the legislature refused to provide specific funding for it. They accused Hobbs of executive overreach for allowing the program to balloon without the necessary funding to pay for it. In the end, the final version of the funding bill that passed through both chambers included the $122 million that Democrats and advocates had begged for to keep DDD solvent, but it also places tighter restrictions on the PPCG program. And the bill allocates $355,000 for a special audit of the program, something that Republicans pushed for to ensure that parents aren't abusing it. Muldoon said that some House Republicans treat the parents who use PPCG like they were draining money from society, even though many of those parents had to quit their jobs to provide full-time care for their children. Muldoon was struck by the House Republicans' decision to walk out of the chamber while DDD parents shared their personal stories last month. Thorne agreed that GOP legislators' efforts to block advocates for the disabled community from sharing how proposed cuts to the PPCG program would impact them was distressing. "I was shocked by the lengths that, especially the House, went through to silence the caregivers and to ensure for a very long time that we didn't have a voice in the hearings," Thorne said. And she thinks there's a simple explanation for House Republicans' repeated refusal to allow the advocates to speak during public hearings where they discuss their gap funding proposals. The optics wouldn't be good for them. "They would have looked really bad," Thorne said. "Our stories are impactful. The way we live our lives does make an impact and motivates people to act for the right reasons." After voting to pass the gap funding bill, legislators from both parties thanked one another for their efforts to finally come together to reach a solution that didn't leave the DDD community in crisis. But Thorne said she wasn't buying that warm sentiments that some of the legislators expressed for those who rely on PPCG. "Particularly disingenuous," Thorne said, were what she called a victory lap from Republican Representative Matt Gress and David Livingston, who had spent months pushing for cuts to the program. Thorne and Muldoon both said that Representatives Nancy Gutierrez, a Democrat, and Julie Willoughby, a Republican, are the legislators who deserve praise for working behind the scenes to ensure that a compromise was reached. "I think she's a really brave person," Muldoon said of Willoughby, who took a stand against her own party last week when they pushed to cut the PPCG program in half, risking her own political career in the process. Both advocates also reserve praise for all the members of the developmental disability community and their supporters for their constant presence at the Capitol to push lawmakers to do the right thing. "I'm so proud of our community," Muldoon said. "But even though they seem to have won this battle, it hasn't been without consequences. Many families lost nurses and outside caregivers as the deadline to fund DDD got closer and closer, and those workers sought jobs with a more certain future. We really need to look inward. We need to do better. This entire process was a disaster," Democratic Senator Annalise Ortiz of Phoenix said Thursday morning before voting for the gap funding bill. And that concludes this story, Disability Funding Crisis Averted, as Hobbs signs bipartisan $122 million rescue package. Our second story, are local officials duty-bound to certify elections? Arizona ruling creates new doubt. Judge pokes holes in a state manual that sought to limit the discretion of county supervisors. That could disrupt the state's criminal case against one of them. By Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, April 29th, 2025. when two Republican Cochise County supervisors delayed their certification of the county's 2022 election results, a judge forced them to certify, pointing to language in Arizona's election manual that says they have no choice. A state grand jury later charged the two supervisors with two felonies, conspiracy and interference with the Secretary of State's duty to certify the election. And two secretaries of state have sought to make the rules about supervisors' duties more explicit. A recent court ruling, though, challenges the long-held presumption in Arizona that supervisors have no discretion when certifying election results. The court threw out that section of the Election Procedures Manual entirely, saying it goes further than the statute supports. The decision could shake up the pending criminal trial against one of the Cochise supervisors, Tom Crosby, as a judge weighs his latest request to dismiss the charges. The other supervisor, Peggy Judd, pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor as part of a deal with prosecutors last year. It could also encourage supervisors across the state to test the boundaries of the state's certification law by attempting to delay or block certification of future elections. Former Pinal County Attorney Ken Volkmer, a Republican, said that's risky and that partisan supervisors shouldn't have that choice. I think it opens it up to potential concerns if you allow essentially one political party entity to essentially hijack an entire election, he said. Ambiguity in election certification laws is a problem in several swing states across the country, including others where local officials have debated whether to certify recent elections, according to a review by Informing Democracy, a nonprofit that studies election administration. While the state's laws typically say local officials shall certify, they don't often specify that they don't have discretion to hold up certification, said Jenny Dimian, the organization's director of election law research and senior policy counsel. Arizona law says supervisors shall certify election results, and courts in the last few years have interpreted that to mean they must do so. The latest court ruling doesn't say supervisors have discretion. It just says that's for the courts to decide, not Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, who wrote a detailed interpretation of the supervisor's non-discretionary role in the latest version of the Elections Procedure Manual. Informing Democracy suggests it's best to make it as explicit as possible in the statutes that local officials don't have discretion when finalizing election results. Arizona's lawmakers have a different idea. A bill from State Representative Rachel Jones, a Republican from Tucson, would prohibit the Attorney General from prosecuting supervisors who refuse to certify results. It passed the House and is awaiting a final vote in the Senate. Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, is unlikely to sign it. Jones said during a February committee hearing that the bill was a direct response to the Cochise County Supervisor's case, and she believes challenging results during the certification process fall somewhere in their First Amendment right. What Arizona law and election manual say about certification? Arizona statute says that supervisors shall meet and canvass the election within 20 days of a general election unless results from polling places are missing. Even then, they can postpone certification only up to 6 times. The term canvass and certify are both used in the statute, but they aren't defined. They're often taken to mean something similar, to finalize results. The statute also says that supervisors must determine the vote, but it doesn't clarify what that means, and it's silent as to what discretion, if any, supervisors have. Until 2019, the Elections Procedures Manual simply outlined the statute, emphasizing the timeline for certification. But in 2019, Hobbs, who was then Secretary of State, expanded that section, adding the word non-discretionary to describe the supervisor's mandate. the Board of Supervisors has a non-discretionary duty to canvass the returns as provided by the county recorder or other officer in charge of elections, and has no authority to change vote totals or reject the election results, that edition of the manual said. Her successor, Fontes, made more changes to the manual after GOP leaders and candidates pressured county officials to use the certification step to block the 2020 and 2022 election results. That update also said supervisors can't delay certifying the results without express statutory authority or a court order. Fontes also added a line saying that if a county's canvass isn't received by deadline, the Secretary of State must proceed with the state canvass without the results of that county, essentially threatening to disenfranchise a county's voters if its supervisors don't do their job. Republicans challenged those parts of the manual, along with many others, in several lawsuits. In December, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Scott Blaney ruled that Fontes overstepped when writing that county supervisors, when certifying results, have no authority to change vote totals, reject election results, or delay certifying. He also said that the Secretary of State can't exclude a county's results from its statewide canvass. The Secretary has relied on the statute's silence and interpreted it to preclude the Board of Supervisors from doing anything other than opening the returns and counting what they find, Blaney wrote. But again, it is the court's role, not the Secretary's, to interpret. Blaney said the appropriate time to determine the meaning of the provision is once the issue actually arises in an election and is ripe for determination on specific existing facts. In other words, if supervisors actually refuse to certify an election on time and the question goes to courts with results hanging in the balance. Fontes has appealed Blaney's ruling. Ruling may force a new look at Tom Crosby's case. Part of the reason that the duty is non-discretionary, Volkmer said, is that county officials have a tight timeline to finalize their results and send them to the Secretary of State's office, at which point they can be challenged in court during the contest period allocated in the law. Crosby said he voted to delay the certification in 2022 because he wanted to hear more testimony from residents who claimed that the voting machines weren't properly accredited. Hobbs, who was then Secretary of State and Governor-elect, sued to force the county to certify. Pima County Judge Casey McGinley heard the case on December 1, 2022, and ordered the supervisors to meet to certify that same day. It was two business days before Hobbs' December 5th deadline to certify statewide results. McGinley said during the hearing that the non-discretionary duty language in the manual appropriately describes the supervisor's duties and does not contradict the statute, and it has the force of law. Similarly, when considering Crosby's first attempt to get the charges dismissed 2 years later, the Arizona Court of Appeals wrote in December that his vote on certifying the election was non-discretionary. The ordinary meaning of shall in a statute is to reflect a mandatory duty, the court wrote at the time. And by cutting into the Secretary of State's certification timeline, the judges said, Crosby's delay may amount to interference. Alex Scalata, Arizona director of All Voting is Local, said he still believes the law is clear and that the board's duty is ministerial. The process to resolving election disputes is through the formal court contests, not local certification, so it doesn't become a political process, he said. They haven't been able to win in courts, he said, and they want to move an evidence-based process into the politically charged Board of Supervisors process. Crosby is now again asking the court to dismiss the case on the grounds that the state didn't provide evidence to support the conspiracy charge before trial. He also contends in court filings that the state has not explained which duty of the Secretary of State he interfered with. He also goes back to what he has been contending since the beginning of the Cochise saga, that the board's job is not to rubber stamp the results. Clearly, any reasonable supervisor or any person would reasonably believe that the required canvassing and certification of the vote had to mean more than merely ignoring it and passing it on to the SOS, he wrote. That is simply an absurd interpretation. And with that, we conclude this story. Are local officials duty-bound to certify elections? Arizona ruling creates new doubt. Next up, UA student's life upended after his visa is suddenly revoked, then reinstated. I didn't even tell my parents, especially my mom. International students across the country have been on a legal roller coaster. By John Washington of Arizona Luminaria, April 29, 2025. It's been a whirlwind few weeks for Amir, a University of Arizona PhD student who, in early April, was putting final touches on his resume to go on the job market and was preparing for his oral examinations. But then, on April 10th, he got an email from the university. This is a quote. "I am reaching out to you regarding your immigration record," the email began. It was from school staff members in charge of updating the online database for international students. They had discovered Amir's status as a student had been terminated in a database maintained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. "Please come in to discuss this at your earliest convenience," the email concluded. Reading on his laptop in his office, Amir was stunned. He was supposed to meet with his advisor to go over a research paper he had been finishing. Instead, he suddenly had to come to terms with a completely different future. "I was so frustrated, I was so upset and overwhelmed that my initial reaction was that I didn't know if I wanted to pursue fighting the case," he told Arizona Luminaria. Amir is a pseudonym. Because of fears of retaliation from the government and possible detention, Arizona Luminaria is not naming him, his country of origin, or his field of study. Arizona Luminaria corroborated his story with a faculty member at UA and an attorney who has represented Amir. It is unclear exactly how many international students in Arizona or across the country have had their visas revoked, but it is at least 1,200. Arizona Luminaria reported earlier in April that at least 50 ASU students had their visas revoked. UA Faculty Senate Chair Layla Hudson said on April 13th, at least 10 UA students had also been targeted. Despite getting immediate support from his faculty chair and International Student Services at UA, Amir was still scared. "The first 2 days, I was lost completely. I couldn't think at all," Amir said. "The situation was so surreal, unexpected. I was concerned about my paper, my resume, my studies, my source of happiness. My life was in the office. My life was being a teacher and a researcher. And then, with one email, all that changed. Now my life was reading the law to see if someone might come and detain me at my house. And then, abruptly, on April 25th, ICE said it would reinstate status for most of the foreign students who had had their visas revoked." Amir got the news around noon that day. He was relieved but said he wasn't ready to celebrate. "I need to think," he said. "I need some time to think about what's next." The university continues to respect the privacy of our international students, faculty, and scholars, and we encourage them to contact us with any questions they may have, a UA spokesperson said. An ASU spokesperson said none of the school students have been deported by the federal government. Federal authorities have revoked visas for some of the university's students. ASU students are being reinstated as part of the latest development, a spokesperson for ASU told Arizona Luminaria via email April 25th. With more than 17,000 international students, ASU has one of the largest international student communities in the country. "I didn't even tell my mom. after he filed a lawsuit against the federal government for what his attorneys were claiming was unlawful termination of his student status and revoking his visa, Amir was nervous enough he would be arrested by immigration officials that he left his apartment and began sleeping on a friend's couch. Amir has been studying in the United States since 2019. He has obtained 2 graduate degrees and was close to obtaining his doctorate. He was also a graduate associate, teaching classes and doing research in exchange for tuition relief and a stipend. When he got the email from the university, his employment had already been terminated immediately because of his revoked status. That meant he was suddenly on the hook for tuition and needed to find money for rent, food, and other basics. Amir said it took a couple of days for the gravity of the situation to sink in. "I didn't even tell my parents, especially my mom," he said. He said he hasn't seen his family in 4 years and has never met his young niece, who is living in his country of origin. He said his parents and wider family saw him, in him, a bright future, and he was scared for them to see it in jeopardy. "I would say I was more sad about it for my mom than myself," Amir said. Jesse Evan Schroeder, an attorney with Green Evan Schroeder, a Tucson-based firm that has been representing international students, called the situation absolutely heartbreaking. Evan Schroeder said she's spoken to both students and parents who have sacrificed a lot to have the chance to study in the United States. She said there is absolute terror the money and effort they've spent will go to waste. "There's terror about being detained by ICE," Evan Schroeder added. Since his status has been reinstated, department members told Arizona Luminaria they hope he can work again soon. Back to school for now. Now that Amir is allowed to study again, that's what he plans to do. But he also said he's realized something. Coming to a country where human rights are appreciated, the whole world thinks about the U.S. in such a prestigious way. But what's happening is obviously against the law. You don't expect the U.S. government to start something without knowing if it's illegal, unless they just don't care. "This for me was racist more than anything," Amir said, referencing the understanding that a lot of the known student revocations have been for students from China, India, or Muslim-majority countries. "It's that they just don't like you." Evan Schroeder said that given continued uncertainty, their firm will not give up the lawsuits. "The litigation will continue as we need assurances that they will not now try to detain these students and charge them with removal," she said. Amir said that he's hoping he'll be able to finish his studies, obtain his doctorate, and go on the job market. But now he's considering the need of looking for work outside of the United States. "I just need to be by myself right now. I just need to think things through. There was this huge downfall in the trajectory of my life, and I need to see myself up or around." He added, "Some of the opportunities are compromised." And that concludes this story, UA student's life upended after his visa is suddenly revoked, then reinstated. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Starting the second half of our program, trans advocacy group endorses Grijalva as progressive frontrunner in special election. Christopher Street Project's first ever endorsement bolsters Grijalva amid federal anti-trans policies. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 30th, 2025. Adelita Grijalva has won the endorsement of the country's first organization dedicated to champion pro-trans candidates in her bid to win a special congressional election in southern Arizona, strengthening her ties to trans rights advocacy amid worsening hostility from the federal government, even as some in the Democratic Party move to the right on the issue. Grijalva is campaigning for a chance to represent Arizona's 7th Congressional District, a seat held for over 2 decades by her father, progressive giant Raul Grijalva, until his death last month at 77, following a long battle with lung cancer. The younger Grijalva, a veteran of Tucson area politics who currently sits on the Pima County Board of Supervisors, faces a crowded field in July's Democratic primary. But she has quickly emerged as the frontrunner, gathering the required number of signatures to qualify for the ballot within hours of her announcement to run, and nabbing endorsements from prominent political figures, including U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego. The Christopher Street Project, a national trans electoral advocacy organization established to counter the GOP's anti-trans focus, announced Wednesday it was backing Grijalva. The group's support cements her progressive bona fides and signals to voters that she hasn't joined the faction of the Democratic Party that is willing to compromise trans rights for electoral appeal. During last year's election, as Republicans and President Donald Trump poured millions into campaign ads attacking trans people, Democratic congressional candidates in red states and battleground states adopted anti-trans talking points of their own. And in January, two Texas Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives sided with Republicans to vote for legislation that would have prohibited trans girls in public schools from joining sports teams that best align with their gender identity. In a written statement, Grijalva celebrated the endorsement from the Christopher Street Project and called the anti-trans attacks from Republicans hateful, dangerous, and shameful. She vowed to push back on legislation targeting trans people and to keep fellow party members on track. In Congress, I'll fight alongside the Christopher Street Project to defend our trans communities, hold Democrats accountable to their promises, and push back against every effort to strip away our rights, Grijalva said. Our message is clear. Trans people belong, and we won't back down. Tyler Hack, the 19-year-old founder of the Christopher Street Project, which is named after the New York City where the Stonewall Inn is located, said that Grijalva was the perfect choice for the organization's first ever political endorsement, given her history of consistent allyship. She has spent 2 decades on the Tucson Unified School District's governing board and has spent 4 years on the Board of Supervisors, where she was often involved with local LGBTQ and Pride Month events. Adelita Grijalva is a proven champion for trans rights, and in the midst of this unprecedented state-sponsored attack on trans people, we need her voice in Congress, Hack said in a written statement. Trump has issued multiple executive orders intended to make it impossible for trans people to live as themselves, including by erasing the federal recognition of trans people's existence, prohibiting pronoun use in federal agencies, threatening to cut federal funding from healthcare organizations that offer gender-affirming care, laying the groundwork to ban trans people from the military, and reinterpreting federal protections in a way that excludes gender identity so as to bar trans girls from joining school sports teams that best reflect who they are. The Republican-controlled Congress is in lockstep with Trump's anti-trans vision, proposing bills that discriminate against trans people in athletics, public facilities, housing, school, and government identification documents. Hack said the only way to ensure a bulwark against that tide of attacks is by electing Democrats that are serious about protecting trans people. The Democratic Party needs to hold up its responsibility to all marginalized peoples, and that includes trans people, they said. Democratic voters aren't happy with the abdication to Trump and to MAGA Republicans. We need fighters who will step up and support trans people in every way that they can. Along with pushing back on the anti-trans agenda at the federal level, Hack said that a pro-trans candidate is needed to help ensure local resources for trans people, which are increasingly under attack from the Trump administration, remain available. That's because the threats from Trump and Republicans in Congress have resulted in state-based organizations complying in advance with discriminatory directives to avoid future consequences, even at the expense of trans people. Shortly after the Arizona branch of Planned Parenthood received a letter from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services instructing it not to use Medicaid funding to pay for gender-affirming care, the organization voluntarily froze its trans health care services out of a, quote, abundance of caution. Following public backlash, those services were restored. That, Hack said, is a clear example of a time when a trans-friendly advocate like Rehalva can be critical for trans Arizonans. Having someone who we can call, who can actually push an organization or a group to stand up for trans people and to not abdicate to Trump's attacks is crucial, they said. The Christopher Street Project's vote of confidence is also a boost for Grijalva's status as an advocate for LGBTQ rights, helping level the playing field against her most high-profile opponent, former State Representative Daniel Hernandez. He was one of Arizona's few openly gay state lawmakers, was a founding member of the state legislature's LGBTQ caucus, and spent years supporting working to enshrine LGBTQ rights into state statutes and speaking out against discriminatory legislation. Hack said the organization is working to mobilize volunteers in Arizona on behalf of Grijalva's bid and pointed out that the election for the congressional district seat will be one of the first to take place since Trump took office in January. That, they said, gives the organization and trans advocates across the state an opportunity to flex their political muscles. This is the first special election in a safe blue or competitive district since Trump took office this year, Hack said. There hasn't been an opportunity to demonstrate trans political power yet, and we're so excited to bring that to Arizona's CD7. The district, which spans much of southern Arizona, leans Democratic, with the percentage of votes cast for Democratic candidates more than doubling those cast for Republicans. That concludes this story. Trans advocacy group endorses Grijalva as progressive frontrunner in special election. Our next story, I wanted to kill them all. Inmate admits to targeting child sex offenders in prison killings. Ricky Wassenaar is already serving 16 life sentences, said his only regret is, quote, not killing more. By Michael Kiefer, April 28, 2025. Ricky Wassenaar killed three men at Arizona State Prison near Tucson on April 4th. Two were serving life sentences for sexual conduct with a minor. The third had raped and killed a 15-year-old girl. Wassenaar's only regret was that he didn't kill more. Child molesters, I want to kill them all, that's all I can say, he told the Arizona Mirror in a recent phone call. But he did say more. The taxpayers no longer have to pay for them, he continued. I'm paying my debt to society. The Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry is investigating what happened that day. No charges have been filed yet, and a spokesperson for the Pima County Attorney's Office said that Corrections has not yet referred its investigation to their office. The Corrections Department has not commented on the matter other than to condemn the violence and note that it was quickly curtailed. Wassenaar, who is known in prison as, quote, Rooster, is already serving 16 life sentences for his part in a 2004 jailbreak attempt that ended in a 15-day hostage standoff at the Lewis Prison in Buckeye. He has spent 38 of his 62 years in Arizona prisons, with just a four-month stint on the outside. And the Pima County attorney, Laura Conover, has written newspaper op-eds declaring her aversion to the death penalty. Wassenaar also claims he killed a fourth prisoner last November because he didn't want to share a cell. He said he strangled the man with his bare hands, but Corrections didn't believe him, and the autopsy conducted by the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner could not definitively determine that the man, also a sex offender, was murdered. Nonetheless, he insisted that he killed the man, telling an investigator from his last trial and a prison advocate who relayed the information to corrections that he would kill anyone else they assigned to his cell. "You've got to give him an A for effort," said Carlos Garcia, the president of the Arizona Correctional Peace Officers Association. The corrections department was playing chicken with Wassenaar, Garcia said. He told them he was going to kill someone. They didn't listen, and he did it. "I'm a killer now. I last spoke to Wassenaar 20 years ago when he was defending himself in trial for the attempted escape and prison takeover. I distinctly recall the sheriff's detention officer escorting me to a holding cell, locking me in with Wassenaar and then leaving. Like many accused and convicted criminals I have interviewed, Wassenaar was a paradox, a grab bag of hatred and loyalties with a strict code of honor despite his lawlessness. On the day I interviewed him, he fretted over the fact that it was my wife's birthday. Shouldn't I be home with her? He talked about his own mother, how he wanted to be imprisoned close enough to his native Michigan so that she could visit him. And when she died, he told me, he wasn't sure he still wanted to stay alive. He is still close to his sister Rhonda, who talks to him regularly, and who herself was convicted of a conspiracy to spring him from custody when he was to be transferred to Ohio to serve his sentence. What I remember most vividly is his account of why he was sent to Lewis Prison in the first place. In 1986, Wassenaar was arrested for armed robbery and aggravated assault. I know nothing about those crimes, but after 10 years, he was released on home arrest and was staying with a family in Tucson. He had a whole list of people he was angry at when he got out, and he told me the anger buzzed in his head like a hive of bees. He had been out for more than 4 months when he walked into a Tucson video shop with the intent of renting a pornographic video. The shop clerk asked him for a phone number, and Wassenaar didn't want to give him the only number he had, which belonged to the people he was staying with. The clerk ridiculed him, so the next night, Wassenaar came back with a gun and held up the shop. Then he took off in a car and led police on a high-speed chase that ended in a crash. Wassenaar said he woke up on a hospital gurney. There was a TV set right above him, showing the evening news and flashing his photograph. Suddenly, the buzzing had stopped, he told me, and he realized he was going back to prison. Last week during our phone call, I reminded him of our earlier conversations. I was a whole different person then, he said, and when I asked him how so, he answered, I'm a killer now. I was never a killer before. The 15-day siege. In January 2004, Wassenaar almost escaped from prison. But instead of making it outside the prison walls, he and his prison mate ended up starting the longest ever hostage situation at a prison. He had worked in the prison legal library and felt he was discriminated against by prison management in ways he was punished, a belief that has been a running theme throughout his prison life. He now worked in the kitchen as a cook, and he put together a plan with another inmate in the kitchen, Stephen Coy. On a January morning, when they knew the mess hall would be understaffed, they sprung the plan. Wassenaar overpowered a correctional officer, handcuffed him, and took his uniform. He shaved off his own beard to more closely resemble a correctional officer. He asked the other prisoners in the cafeteria if they wanted to join him, but they refused. So he headed out the door to a nearby guard tower. The guard tower was a short stop on the way to the prison administration building and a door outside of the prison to freedom. One of the guards on duty in the tower, Jason Auk, mistook Wassenaar for the officer he had overpowered and buzzed him in. Wassenaar pulled his cap down until Auk reached him and then pulled a metal paddle from one of the kitchen's industrial mixers out of the pocket of his cargo pants and smacked Auk across the side of the head, knocking him nearly senseless. The second guard in the tower, Lois Fraley, charged him, but he subdued her and handcuffed her. Then, taking an automatic rifle from the tower, he went to see what was holding up Coy. Wassenaar later said he knew little about why Coy had been in prison. Coy was a convicted rapist, and while Wassenaar was taking the tower, Coy was raping a female civilian worker in the kitchen. otherwise they might have pulled off an escape. When Wassenaar stepped out of the tower, other correctional officers had Coy spread eagle on the ground. Wassenaar sprayed bullets over their heads. One of them asked who he was shooting at, to which Wassenaar answered, "You." The officers retreated, and Wassenaar pulled Coy into the tower. The next 15 days were high drama as Wassenaar negotiated with prison officials and other law enforcement agencies. At one point, during a whispered phone call, Wassenaar told negotiators that he had sent Coy to the tower where they could get a shot at him. Sharpshooters drew a bead on a person in the tower they thought was Coy, then held fire when they realized it could be Ouch. Wassenaar made demands for Philly cheesesteaks, Coke, cigarettes, and meatball subs, and raged if he didn't get them. He screamed at the hostage negotiators, once while he held a shotgun to Ouch's head, and another time when he threatened to cut off one of Fraley's fingers. Coy raped Fraley. Wassenaar was also charged and convicted of sexual assault for an incident that took place during the early hours of the siege. They were on the floor of the tower below the windows to avoid snipers, and Wassenaar was pulling off Fraley's pants to give them to Coy to wear as a disguise. Her underwear came off with her pants, and Wassenaar allegedly put his finger in her vagina at that moment and made remarks. He denied it happened, but the jury concluded that it did. Eventually, Coy and Wassenaar surrendered after getting assurances they would be transferred to prisons out of Arizona. They had a last meal with a couple of beers before they left the tower. Courtroom drama. The trial began a year and a day after the start of the siege. It was a circus. Wassenaar chose to defend himself, and he was well matched by the prosecutor, Deputy Maricopa County Attorney Jeanette Gallagher, a tough-talking Chicagoan with a glare and a growl that was just as intimidating as Wassenaar's. Coy had already pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 7-6 consecutive life sentences to start after the 185 years he was already serving. He was whisked off to a prison in Maine. Wassenaar had attended the pre-trial proceedings in shackles and jail stripes, but during the trial he was dressed out in civilian clothes with a stun belt under his shirt and nylon bands binding his legs to his chair. At times it was amusing, and admittedly the media who attended the overflow courtroom was at times charmed by Wassenaar. Once when he took the witness stand before the jury came in, Wassenaar grabbed the microphone and pretended he was a club DJ, asking for song suggestions and then saying he was going to play the Lynyrd Skynyrd song Free Bird. On multiple occasions, Gallagher would storm out of the courtroom and utter angry epithets that journalists could not report. When Judge Warren Granville asked Wassenaar how far he had got in school, Wassenaar answered, "DOC documents will tell you I have a GED. Others will tell you I have a master's degree in being a dumbass." Ouch, the male correction officer taken hostage, withered on the stand under Wassenaar's questioning. Fraley, however, was confident and unyielding. She told the jury how Wassenaar would make her mop blood and urine off the floor. She fantasized about dumping the buckets over his head and jumping from the tower. "A couple of broken legs I would have been satisfied with," she said. On another day, Wassenaar's withering gaze was countered by Maricopa County Sheriff Sergeant Kip Rustenberg, who had been one of the hostage negotiators during the siege. When Wassenaar said something offensive, she flashed her eyes and smiled at him slyly without saying a word. He had to turn away, half laughing, but clearly intimidated. And though he denied the sex assault charges and attempted murder charges for shooting at correctional officers, the jury found him guilty of 19 counts. He was sentenced to 16 life sentences, a harsh enhancement for committing the crimes while he was already in prison. Wassenaar was sent to a prison in Ohio. He was later transferred to New Mexico, out of sight and out of mind, before coming back to a prison in Tucson in 2016 and housed in a sex offender unit. In Wassenaar's mind, he was sent back because Charles Ryan, then the corrections director, wanted his pound of flesh. Wassenaar had embarrassed the department. Ryan, he said, wanted revenge before he died. "I wanted to kill them all. Much of the following account comes from my recent conversation with Wassenaar. He was calling from prison, limited in time. The phone cut off in mid-sentence. Other information comes from court records and from conversations with Donna Hamm of the prison advocacy organization Middle Ground. Hamm has spoken to various people with knowledge of the events. None of it, other than the victims' names, has been confirmed by the Corrections Department or the Pima County Attorney's Office. Wassenaar told Hamm that he didn't want to share a cell with another prisoner. When they moved Joseph DeSisto into the cell, Wassenaar told Hamm he tried to block the door to keep him out. DeSisto, 81, had been convicted of multiple counts of child sex abuse and sexual conduct with a minor. DeSisto was found dead in the cell on November 5, 2024, which Wassenaar made a point of reminding me was Election Day. Wassenaar said he strangled DeSisto. "I choked him with an arm bar and then with my hands," he told me, and he said that he was dripping sweat all over DeSisto from the effort, something he told Hamm as well, and said he left DNA evidence on DeSisto's body. DeSisto's autopsy noted Wassenaar's allegation, but the medical examiner found no signs of strangulation. There were no marks on DeSisto's neck, and his hyoid bone, an indicator of strangulation if broken, was intact. He had broken ribs, according to the report, a common injury that occurs during CPR, and Wassenaar volunteered that prison EMTs had in fact broken DeSisto's ribs. The cause of death was inconclusive. Wassenaar told Hamm and me that he got the equivalent of a 30-day timeout, even though he confessed to killing the cellmate. He called his former trial investigator. He called Hamm. He wanted to be implicated in DeSisto's death. He thought DeSisto's family would want to know what happened to him. Hamm asked him, "Why would you kill someone if you're so concerned about their family?" He said he just wanted to be alone, but he insisted on his guilt. "I gave a detailed account," he told me. He told Hamm he had made it clear to his keepers that if they put anyone else in his cell, he would kill them too. "He wants to do his time the way he wants to do it," she said. In the meantime, in December, on the anniversary of his mother's death, he said he picked out a good-sized rock from the prison yard and saved it in his cell. By the morning of April 4th, prison authorities had put an inmate named Saul Alvarez in Wassenaar's cell. Alvarez had kidnapped a 15-year-old girl in 1998, raped her, and killed her. Hamm had been told that Wassenaar suffocated him and stabbed him to death with a shank and arranged Alvarez's body on his bed to make it look like he was asleep. He took the rock he had saved and put it in his fishnet laundry bag and headed out to the prison yard. In the yard, other prisoners were starting to assemble in line for breakfast. Outside the mess hall door was a long passageway enclosed in chain-link fence that the prisoners called the cage. Wassenaar came in and started swinging his rock. He felt he had jumped the gun. "If I had waited until they were all locked in that cage, I could have killed 10 or 12," he said. Instead, he killed two, Thorne Harnage and Donald Lashley, both of whom were serving life sentences for sexual conduct with a minor. Another prisoner tried to stop him, and Wassenaar said he stabbed him. "He was overpowered before he had finished," he told me. "I wanted to kill them all." And that concludes this story. "I wanted to kill them all. Inmate admits to targeting child sex offenders in prison killings." And we just have one final note before we wrap up. Arizona's Mojave County approves security marks on ballot paper for 2026 by Jen Fifield of VoteBeat. This was from April 24th, 2025. Arizona's Mojave County plans to add security features to its ballot paper for the 2026 midterm election, a measure officials hope will improve voter confidence. The features could include watermarks or invisible fibers, according to a contract with election printing vendor Runbeck Election Services that county supervisors unanimously voted to approve on Monday. The features will cost somewhere between 10 to 15 cents a ballot, according to Runbeck's proposal. About 83,000 Mojave County voters cast ballots in the last midterm election. Supervisors, chairmen, Travis Lingenfelter said in an interview Tuesday that he thinks the change is worth the cost if it improves voter confidence, and he hopes other counties will follow. The decision by an all-Republican board representing the conservative northwest corner of the state comes 4 years after GOP activists began to spread false claims that fake ballots were inserted into the state's 2020 presidential election to rig the election for Joe Biden, claims that were then repeated by GOP candidate Carrie Lake about the 2022 election after she lost the governor's race. Several audits prove Biden and Governor Katie Hobbs, both Democrats, won Arizona, and courts have rejected any claim of widespread fraud in the election. The state has multiple checks and balances to ensure that only ballots cast by registered voters are counted, including physical security and auditing protocols, such as those that reconcile the number of ballots cast with the number of voters who participated. And it looks like that's all the time we're going to have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. If you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on On-Demand Podcasts. And don't forget that you can get our stream and on-demand podcasts on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we'll look forward to seeing you again with the Arizona Mirror next week. Bye-bye.